Following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Once again, here's John Michael Cutter and his guest, Everett D. Reamer.
Well, as you probably already know, the Japanese military had put out orders that had there been a land invasion of Japan proper, all POWs held by them would have been eliminated by whatever means the Japanese military decided to, or how they decided to do it. We would have all been killed. Truman, giving the order, realized the death struggle and the high casualty rate that would have occurred had there been a land invasion of Japan proper. It would have been a suicide mission for us and our troops. I think we would have been victorious in the end, but all of we POWs would not have survived. We would have all been killed. So I think it was a wise decision. It not only saved thousands of our own troops, it saved thousands of Japanese lives as well. Mm-hmm. It was a great decision, and without that, I think the war would have been extended. Some say, I just read or received from a naval individual, the Olympic plan that we had for invading Japan. It had underestimated so much in so many different areas. And it would have been a greater slaughter than we had originally anticipated.
There had been estimates at one point that there would have been 1 million man casualties on both sides.
True.
If that had taken place. And it was becoming apparent that the Japanese were determined to fight to the very last man. Firebombing raids were responsible for eliminating 150,000 individuals in one raid, and that wasn't making any difference in attitude at that point. So I think in reality, that's absolutely right. And I think it wasn't a cavalier decision. I mean, there are historians who suggest that it was Truman's intent to use the atomic bomb as just one more piece of artillery. I think the telling story for me is that while he was at Potsdam the day before signing the authorization, Truman ended up in two church services. He went to a church service that was part of his particular church, and then he ended up at a friend who was a member of his regiment during the First World War and was chief of army chaplains. So I think it was a soul-searching decision for Truman, but at the end, I think you're right. I think it was absolutely the right decision, and I think those of us who are children of parents in the Second World War who were in the Pacific Theater probably are here today because of that decision.
So, without a doubt, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. I'm just so grateful for that decision. It's and all of we former POWs of the Japanese owe a great debt of gratitude to him.
And after the August dropping of the atomic bomb, how long was it before you were eventually liberated?
Well, things got rather harsh during that period of time. They started opening the cell door and handcuffing my hands behind my back and so forth. And I was so pleased when that stopped because I didn't know what the intent was by doing that. And on August 22nd, 1945, I had received the largest bowl of rice that I had ever received since being in solitary. And I was in the process of eating my rice with chopsticks, I might add. My cell door opened and the guard motioned for me to come out. And I, of course, wasn't about to leave that large bowl of rice. And so eventually he came in and just pulled me out of my cell. And when he did that, I saw the other seven Allied POWs lined up outside. I said, oh, crap, they're going to kill us. This is the final move. And from there, we were marched up to the control center for the cell block. And there I saw the Japanese flag that normally was on the wall behind this podium with the face to the wall. And I thought then, this is they wouldn't have gone to that trouble had they been going to kill us. So I felt a great bit of relief. And then we were taken up into a room, and there there was two high-ranking military officers with an interpreter. One of the officers spoke in Japanese, and the interpreter interpreted it. And he said, the war is now over. We are now friends. And then we were taken, of course, to the control center for the prison and given old Japanese uniforms and so forth and weighed. And I weighed 92 pounds at that time.
And when you went in, how much did you weigh?
Into the military?
Mm-hmm.
About 165, 170.
And you're a big man. I mean,
I was 5'11 at the time. Yeah.
Which was, for those days, I was a tall man. Yeah. My goodness. It was 1st Cavalry that first came into the islands to liberate.
Yes. But what happened was when we were relieved from the prison, we were put on a truck. Four of us on each side of the truck, and the two Japanese officers was on a bench that was directly behind the cab of the truck, overlooking the tailgate, basically. And as we traveled down through the outskirts of Osaka, we were to be taken back to the camps from which we came. So along the road, occasionally, there would be a dead body that had not been recovered. And this little guy from Oklahoma, he started, I was on the end by the tailgate, and he was adjacent to me on one side. And he started pointing to these dead bodies, and he started screaming, "You bastards got what you deserve," and pointing to these bodies. And I poked him with my elbow, kind of leaned over to him to whisper to him. I said, "Look, Brad, we've made it this far. Don't screw it up now." These guys were armed. They could have killed us, and nobody would have ever known what happened to us. And so eventually we end up back to the camp from where we were, and we got off and started looking around. And the camp that we had been in had been bombed and burned to the ground because it was right in the waterfront area of Osaka. So we roamed around for a couple of days and there, and finally ended deciding to go over to Kobe, and we had heard some other Americans were over there. So we go to a train station. It was still operational. And as we started to board the train, we had no fare, no fees, you know, nothing to warrant us getting on board. But as we started on the train, the Japanese civilians just split and bowed to us as we walked onto the train. So we ended up over in Kobe, Japan. And there we were there a couple of days, and the Frenchman that had been in solitary came up and had us go down to his home. He was married to a Japanese woman, and she fed us and that for a couple of days. But when he heard that the Americans, through radio, that Americans had come on board, then he took us back to the camp there in Kobe where there were other Americans. And we joined them, and of course there were airdrops of supplies to us during that brief period of time. And on September the 6th, 1945, the 1st Cav came in with a medical team to evaluate us. So I guess I was still pretty much a basket case, according to them. I didn't know. I felt good. I was happy to be retrieved, and I really felt great. But I was taken then to a hospital ship in Yokohama, the Marigold, and stayed there a couple of days, and then was taken by ambulance to Otsuki Air Base and put on a hospital plane and flown back to San Francisco. When I left San Francisco, we traveled under the Golden Gate Bridge, and I traveled first class, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And coming back, we flew directly over the Golden Gate Bridge, and as I looked out the hospital plane, looked over on the hillside white stones, it said, "Welcome home." And that was certainly a wonderful feeling.
The Philippines really is the first salvo of the war after the attack on Pearl Harbor. And it really is a forgotten chapter in the war effort and the strength and the determination of the first American forces to be called into the war effort and what they did. How many in all were in the Philippines at that time? 36,000, something like
that?
Well,
there was a total, we're talking about the Pacific operation, Guam, Wake Island, and so forth, 36,000. But in the Philippines, there was total was about 29,000.
29,000. And how many of those men were lost through that effort? And then
40% died in captivity and from the battle.
And by comparison, the Japanese internment, the Japanese prisoner of war experience was far more decimating than the European POW experience ever was.
Well, in Germany, there was from 1% to 2% that was lost in captivity. Mm-hmm. But the brutality, the Japanese hated the Americans with a passion. There was no concern for their well-being, for medication, for food. It was pretty much catch-as-catch-can. It was just a miracle any of us survived. Mm,
truly, truly. And the American cemetery in the Philippines is still the largest cemetery outside of Arlington to this day.
Yes, and I might add it's beautifully kept. They maintain it.
Just an incredible story. But the story still goes on because you came back to the United States. You had a productive career after the war. You raised a happy and successful family. And just recently, besides a number of trips that you've taken back to the Philippines as representative for the Survivors Organization, but you had a chance to go back to Japan recently and visit the place of your internment. Tell us a little bit about what that was like.
Well, in January of 2006, I've made five trips back to the Philippines since and starting in 1992 on the 50th anniversary. And I had an opportunity to go back and help dedicate a Hellship Memorial at Subic Bay in the Philippines. And there were four of us former POWs there for this dedication. And a number of descendants that had lost their fathers on these ships being transported to Japan. And so I felt an obligation to go back and help dedicate this memorial. It's a beautiful memorial, marble, overlooking Subic Bay. It'll be there for all time, for everyone to view. So I felt an obligation to do that. We did the dedication. And I decided that this was my probably only opportunity that I would have to go back to Japan proper. So I made arrangements with the State Department and so forth to go to Osaka and ended up going there and visiting the prison where I was held in solitary back during those years and met with the current warden of the prison who said he was unaware that there were any POWs held there during that period of time.
During that period of time. Yeah. And that's been a longstanding issue with the Japanese government. Historical accuracy in reporting has been at a minimum, I would say, to be polite.
Well, everything has been altered to make it look like it was our problem, not theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an ongoing discussion.
The forced labor camp is gone now.
Right.
It was firebombed during the war after you had left.
Yes.
So
I was able to stand on the ground where it was.
Where it was.
Yeah. And a few of the warehouses that I worked in are still standing.
What was it like to go back inside the prison?
It was kind of a self-searching deal. The old prison that I was actually in had been torn down. And the new prison had been built in 1995 and 96. But they had a museum area that I was shown that was supposed to have duplicated the cells of that era, which it did not. Hmm. They had running water in this cell, for instance, and they had bedding that was somewhat different and so forth.
Tell us about the survivors of Corregidor and Bataan that you represent today.
Well, actually, I've been active since the 80s. First of all, in the Western States Group, which covered 13 states. I was the commander for that group a number of times. And also, a few years back, I was encouraged to be the leader for the national group. And the national group includes all POWs that was captured by the Japanese in World War II. And so in 2007 and 2008, I was the national commander for this group. We're a unified group. We're like family. we've endured hardships beyond the comprehension of most people today. And so we're blood brothers, in effect.
Truly.
And so we get together, we enjoy, and we reminisce our lucky survival rate and so forth. And it's just amazing that the group is still in existence. We just had our convention that was concluded in Louisville, Kentucky in May. Next year, our final chapter will be in San Antonio, Texas. And then we will be turning everything over to our descendants.
What month is the San Antonio meeting?
It'll be in May.
In May.
May of 2009.
2009. And then in November of this past year, you had a chance to meet the President of the United States.
Actually, I met him on Memorial Day in May.
Okay.
Again, in November, of course. But in May, I had a chance to meet him. We had a photo op, Bernice and I did with him. He's a wonderful person. He mentioned about his father nearly being captured, and had he been captured, they would have assassinated him. And he said, yes, and if that had happened, I wouldn't be here. But I spoke with him for about 5 minutes.
Everett, how old are you today?
I'm 83 and a half. My military age is 85 and a half, of course.
because you were 18 when you were 16. You have the great gift now of perspective. And I have to say, the thing that just amazes me about you is that you really don't bear animus in your life. You don't seem to live the tragedy that befell you, and you don't use that as a cheap justification for other things that may cloud other individuals' life. And with as horrible as war is, and with the fact that veterans always come back and say, no one wishes war because of what you endure and what you see, is there a positive that you feel has added to your character, your personal life, that you otherwise might not have had if that experience hadn't occurred?
Well, I think, number one, life in this country is a basis and a foundation that leads you to want to carry on from day to day. When you endure and walk the line between life and death, as we did, you respect life so much more, and you become a giving person rather than a taker. I think that is one of the main assets that you come out with, because God has granted you additional days on this earth, and you become a giving person and not a taker. I have a loving family. And I have a number of loving friends. I just think that it encompasses a total life experience. It's something that it's hard to explain, but I cherish each day of life and what life has to offer. I don't have any regrets, and I hope that I don't have any animosity toward anyone. Having served in the military and having fought in World War II, having endured all of that, it's great for me and others, and especially me, to be proud as I am until the day that I pass to be an American.
Unconquerable Faith, Surviving Corregidor, Bataan, and Japan by Everett D. Reamer. His book is available and distributed worldwide through the media publishing group of Flypaper Productions. Available in paperback for $20 and in audiobook form in a set of two CDs for $30. These prices are in U.S. currency. As part of this special podcast offer, Flypaper Productions will include media shipping and handling at no additional charge. It's important to point out that at the author's election, 100% of the proceeds from sales of Unconquerable Faith, whether it be through this podcast or otherwise, are donated to the author's local Children's Learning Center, part of a 15-state program with a mission of teaching children to read. To order your copy of Unconquerable Faith, whether it's the print edition for $20 or the audiobook version for $30, make your check payable to Flypaper Productions and mail it to our distribution center at P.O. Box 324, Harrison, Ohio, 45030, USA. Thank you for listening.